Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On the brink of OSU's 400th commencement ceremony this weekend, he sits at the top of the heap of the nation's highest paid public university presidents and at the helm of one of the nation's largest universities. OSU President E. Gordon Gee usually is in the mix of any campus controversy, from hate-inspired crimes to critics of privatization. So as the university wraps up its final quarter and moves on to the semester system, Gordon Gee joins us to talk about those issues and more. Welcome back to the show, Gordon Gee.
Oh, well, thank you, Anne. It's great to be here. I appreciate your and you're celebrating 3 years now, nearly.
Coming up on it.
Yeah, that's great. So you've done a great job. We're honored to have you on our team, as a matter of fact.
Thank you very much. Parking. Privatization of parking. Mm-hmm. Vendors have returned proposals to manage the university's parking operations. They've identified a lead bid has been identified. Mm-hmm. It's $483 million for the university and a guaranteed maximum parking rate increase capped at 5.5% for the next 10 years. What of that do you think you're going to go with that?
Well, you know, we're in the process of evaluating it. And as you know, I mean, I've been a strong advocate for this. I'm not making a secret. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm a strong advocate is not, to me, simply about parking, although parking is part of the issue. I want to make certain that we continue to have great rates and high quality and a variety of other things. What it's about the future of the university. The way I look at it is pretty simple. If you think about the world we're in, it's upside down. The grand bargain that was struck with universities 50 years ago, that the federal government would support us and the state government would support us, and we could raise tuition however we wanted to, and we could squeeze the middle class if we wanted to, that grand bargain has been broken. The problem is a lot of people don't quite understand that. If your readership could watch me right now, you know, I have last Saturday, the New York Times had a front page story on the fact that the University of California, California State University, et cetera, that they're closing campuses, their faculty are on furlough, all the other kinds of things. Both the heads of those systems are great friends of mine, and they just admit it, that they just made a mistake, that they should have understood that the grand bargain wasn't going to exist, and they've raised tuition 200% over the last 3 years, and people are rioting in their offices, and we have taken $120 million haircut. Most institutions they'd been letting people go and a variety of other things, but because of the fact that we determined very early on in my second tenure that we needed to come up with a new financial model, we put shock absorbers on, and those shock absorbers have worked for us. And now this is the next iteration of that shock absorber. It is building an ability for us to be able to grow our faculty, to support our graduate students, to support our undergraduates, and also to be able to do it in a way that can continue the momentum of the institution. We have a $16 trillion budget deficit. If anyone thinks that the federal government's going to be sending us money in boatloads, they're wrong. The state, though doing well under the governor, still has tremendous financial problems. The middle class are being squeezed. The president of the United States comes to my campus to announce his reelection, and he takes us to task for charging too much tuition, even though we're one of the great educational bargains in the country. I mean, it's a political issue for us. And so we have to take charge of our own lives. I describe it this way. We are an elephant, and we've got to become a ballerina or we'll become a dinosaur. And you know what happened to dinosaurs. And so we're building a glide path to make certain that we're going to be very successful in terms of the future of this institution, but we're going to take charge of our own agenda. We're not going to be dealing with the vicissitudes of the world that's outside in terms of how they impact the university.
My guest is Ohio State University President Gordon Gee. If you have a question or comment for Gordon Gee, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. As far as the parking goes, what goes into the evaluation? Because much thought was put into the RFP and the request for proposals
and the RFP
first
was, and I'm sorry, I'm stepping
that's okay
on your line.
Well, what what's your timeline?
Well, between now and the time that I make a recommendation to the Board of Trustees, in the end, they're going to be the ones who make the final decision, but that is at the end of June.
Okay.
And obviously, we built in a lot of bells and whistles into the RFP. If the RFP had not been met, then we simply would not look at that particular vendor. The vendor that, I mean, truthfully, the numbers came out, and the vendor that we really liked both came out in exactly the right way. The numbers are powerful. The financial impact on the university is powerful. Those who are running this particular parking company are really elegant people. They are they do the highest quality. They are now at 11 or 12 universities, including the University of California and Yale and Brown, and I know their work. So it's not as if this is an unknown group. So we feel very good, but we want to make certain. You know, we were offered more money, but if we would have taken more money, we also would have had to not been able to cap our parking rates. The 5.5% is what the historical rate has been over the last 10 years. I had this flyer on my I have to laugh about this sometimes. I had this flyer on my windshield today, and it was from some group that said, you know, Dr. Gee, stop this, because this is what our rates are going to look like. And I took a look at it, and of course that's probably what the rates are going to look like, because that's what they would look like if we were running the parking. People, for some reason, rather think that we don't charge for parking. We charge for parking, and we will continue to charge for parking. Over the last 12 years, we've charged about 7.5% for parking increase. So there is no free lunch here, and what we are getting is we're getting cash that we can invest immediately, which will then turn into endowment dollars and will provide us an opportunity to do things that we otherwise would never be able to do.
When you talk about splitting up that $483 million or 450 or whatever it was going to be, a certain number of millions goes to this and a certain millions goes to that. But it's not just cash on the barrel. This is money that is going to be invested, and the proceeds from those investments will go to those different.
Two things. One is the fact that we'll invest it in the university's endowment. And the endowment, fortunately, we're managed by a genius. And even in good times and bad times, our endowment has done very, very well compared with most others. Secondly, Bob, we'll take about 4.5% of the endowment and invest it immediately. And then we'll take another 4.5% and allow the endowment to grow, which then allows us to grow our ability to be able to pay. So the payout is going to be enormous. The payout over the 50 years is going to be about $3 billion, and the endowment growth is going to be about $5 billion,
which of course exceeds whatever revenue would be brought in from.
Well, not only does it exceed, at the end of the day, we still own it. We're not selling it. We're owning it. We're just leasing it. And if you take a look at it, what do you get? What do you get without doing it? You get zero and zero. What do you get with doing it? You get a substantial amount of money and a growth in your endowment. To me, it's simple economics, and it's also powerful economics for the university.
The issue of privatizing the parking operations has raised a larger issue, though, about who has a voice in how the university is managed into the future. And 2 days last month, students gathered from across campus to protest the power structure at OSU. They're concerned, you know, not only about the privatization and the philosophy of privatization, but also how the university's coming to these decisions. They feel left out.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we have one of the most representative governance structures in the country. You know, I've been president. I joke about this. I've been president about half the universities in this country, and I can say this. This is the only university I've been part of in which both students and faculty and administrators have a strong voice in the governance of the institution through our university senate. Secondly of all, we have a university staff advisory council, which is a powerful voice on behalf of the institution, on behalf of our staff. And so in saying that there's not a voice, it's just simply not true. That's nonsense. Now, if their voice is not being heard because of the fact that the university is making different decisions that they want, then that's a different issue. But clearly, this is a university, I think, that values this notion of sharing ideas and sharing governance. At the same time, we're a very large place. We don't run the university by a plebiscite. We run it on the basis of common sense and goodwill, and that's what we're trying to do.
When the issue of privatization came up, what were your personal thoughts about it? Were you skeptical? Did you have concerns about where this might lead down the road?
Well, you know, I've been part of the privatization issue for some time. At West Virginia, we created a public not-for-profit corporation to run our hospital, which turned to be exceedingly successful. At Colorado, I did the same thing again. I've been part of this in various areas, and each time that I've done it very carefully and very thoughtfully, I will add, because I'm just not a privatization guy. I actually like being in charge of the assets that we have. They've turned out to be successful, and for that I'm grateful. For some reason or other, the word privatization conjures up something like corporatization. Those are words that get brought in together. Universities are a big business. We are not a business. We don't make, we don't make cars. We don't make widgets. What we do is we make ideas. But yet we have a $5 billion budget, and we have to make certain that every day that we're meeting our financial expectations. And so, therefore, you have to take a look at it in a balanced approach. And from my point of view, it's about compassion. It's about the young faculty member who was brought here, and then all of a sudden the federal government shuts off the spigot for funding from the National Institutes of Health. It's about a kid from West Liberty, Ohio, that I met, who is a first-generation student. His family owns a pizza parlor there, and he was able to come to this university because we were able to provide him the opportunity to come through scholarships. It's about our staff. I've got 48,000 people with families out there, and we have not let anyone go. We don't have anyone on furlough. We don't have thousands of people that have lost jobs. We have maintained this institution and accelerated. And to me, someone says to me, one of my dear friends said to me, he said, "Well, gee, why would you do that? It's immoral." And I say, "What's immoral is for us not to meet the obligations of the people and the expectations of the students that we have. That's the immorality. That's where we have to deal." So, yeah, I'm passionate about it because I'm passionate about the university.
An email from Cynthia. She says, "Will the new parking vendor do jump starts, provide gasoline, and do lockouts as the current transportation and parking department does?"
Yes.
Okay. "Did I read correctly that you expect a 9% return on the money you get from this lease? If so, where slash who is paying you 9%?
What happens is the fact that it's the way that our endowment works. Our endowment, we have said we believe that we'll get at least a 9%. That's what the historical growth in terms of national endowments have been. Our endowment has been growing since Jonathan Hook has been charged between 15 and 18%. We may get three times that amount of money. And if we didn't have it, we would get into zero in terms of our endowment growth.
So the 9%
is a historical.
Right.
That's our expectation, at least in that area.
Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Well, the previous email just stole all my thunder.
Oh, sorry, Paul.
But
that's all right, Paul. Whatever your thunder is, thunder away, my friend.
Well, no, I had two questions, and I settled on the second, which was just at least answered by you. I will go back to my first question.
Okay.
And your screener was careful, but I still think it's worthwhile. Do you, sir, have any pecuniary interest whatsoever in any of the vendors? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
The answer is absolutely not. And in fact, I'll just say it once and never again. What an offensive question. Do you think that I, in summary, what in hell's sake am I gaining from this personally? I'm not gaining anything. What I'm gaining is an ability to be able to make certain the university is working, and the university is working well. So, Paul, I appreciate your question, but don't ask it again.
Okay. My guest is Gordon Gee. He's president of Ohio State University, and we'll continue our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and internationally renowned guitar superstar Joe Bonamassa delivers a stunning performance at the Beacon Theater in New York City. The show includes new songs and memorable duets with legendary classic rock singers. Watch Joe Bonamassa live from New York. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
74 degrees in downtown Columbus with a mix of sun and clouds today. There is a stray shower possible and a high of 78. A slight chance of showers tonight and a low of 57, sunshine for Friday and a high of 82, and sunshine for Saturday as well with a high of 85. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Gordon Gee. He's president of Ohio State University. We've kind of wrapped up our conversation about the parking, but if you want to have it, if you have any other questions, please give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Heaven knows there's lots to talk about. You are at the top of the heap of public university presidents in terms of your pay. We've talked about this before. It's nearly $2 million in 2011. There are critics, of course. Ohio State isn't the biggest campus out there. So what are the benchmarks?
Ohio State is the biggest campus. Arizona State claims it is, but it doesn't matter. I mean, we're the most complex university in the country by far.
And I was going to say, what benchmarks do you put forth to justify your pay?
Well, I don't justify my pay, and nor should I. If I'm doing a good job, I'm very humbled by the fact that I'm able to be here and do what I do. I'm the longest sitting university president in the country, and I've been doing this for a very long period of time. And I was the highest paid university president in the country when I came here. I actually took a pay reduction to come here. Not many people can say that. And I did do that because the fact that I think that Ohio State is a unique place, and it was in my heart. And how I measure it is by the success that the university is having. And by the way, that's how my pay is measured. People talk about $2 million pay. Most of that is in jeopardy. My base salary is about $800,000. The rest of it is all in jeopardy. If I don't perform, there are very high metrics in that regard. If we don't raise the money we need to, we don't raise the academic standards, we don't get the students, we don't get a variety of things, then I don't get paid. And there are not many people who work on that kind of a basis. So I think that therefore the fact that I have been able to do as well as I hope I'm doing is a measure of the success of the university. And so in the end, it's about outcomes. You know, in the last 4 years, we've raised $1.5 billion. We've got $500 million in terms of cash from our program of the Century Bond. We've got the parking issues, but the most important thing is our numbers are powerful in terms of the quality of the institution. Our faculty are just world-class, continue to hire wonderful people, continue to retain wonderful people. Our students' numbers could not be more powerful. The support for the university could not be more powerful. We raised more money last year than any time in the history of the university, which is a great endorsement of those who believe in Ohio State.
One of the critics of your, pay level made the point about the gap and that there's too much of a gap between top administrators, including you, and the faculty and staff.
Well, I believe in paying. I believe in paying paying everyone exactly at the very top of the scale. Now my pay is the highest in the country, but our benchmark is that we want to be in the top quartile at least, and we are in the top quartile for faculty, staff, and for our deans and our administrators, and that's where we are now. There is pay gaps among our faculty. Our surgeons earn a lot more money than our English faculty do. I think that's fair. Probably not, but that is what happens in this kind of world we find ourselves in. We want to be fair to everyone based upon how we compare ourselves with other institutions, and on our pay, we are very competitive on the national stage.
Evelyn in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. I guess Evelyn is not on the air. Your travel expenses have been another issue, and we've talked about the travel expenses issue before. Again, $840,000 since 2007, and you've made the point that it's a big university, not just here in Columbus, but it's all over the world.
Yeah, but I get slightly irritated by those kinds of things because the end result is, am I doing the work that I should be doing? If you take a look at the letter that the board gave to me, they said, go out there, raise lots of money, raise the visibility, and do whatever it takes. And so therefore, and my travel expenses are audited more than anyone else's. I live within the guidelines. I've never been over budget in terms of our expenditures. So what I think is the fact that if people want to criticize me on the basis of not doing what I'm doing rather than what I'm doing, and that's fine with me. And also I welcome anyone to come and spend a week with me. My schedule is very easy. I got up at 4:30 this morning. I went to bed at 12:30 last night. I do that 7 days a week, and in between, my life is devoted to the point that, my life is devoted to the university. I take a lot of pride in that. In some ways, I ought to have a little bit more balance, I suspect. But it's a brutal schedule, and it's one, though, that is self-imposed, and so I have no one to complain to but myself.
Avalon and Columbus will take one reverse turn. Talk about parking. Welcome.
Thanks. President Gee, what's your response to the report by the faculty committee led by Bruce Whitey?
Bruce Whitey has made his point very clear. And, I know Bruce not well. I just sent him a note, invited him over to lunch because I want to figure out what his report was, what he was doing. In the end, let me just point out that after everyone has studied all these reports, the faculty have studied it. The faculty council voted in favor of moving the parking forward. The University Senate Steering Committee yesterday voted unanimously, as did the Parking Advisory Committee, as did almost every other committee. So I guess my answer is that in the end, Bruce has a very strong point of view. I love his passion, but he's wrong. And after it's been studied, it's very clear that those who on the faculty who've looked at it very carefully believe that this is a project that is worthy of moving forward.
Thank you, Evelyn. You wanted to talk about the value of a college degree, whether it's worth the costs. That's a big issue these days, particularly with students and their parents racking up tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is shocking for an undergraduate degree.
It's shocking not at Ohio State, because we don't do that at Ohio State.
It's very rare, but what sort of there was a story in the paper the other day about 10 universities or university systems collaborating on, or they're going to be forthcoming about what they're doing to what their finances are and how it's figuring in and what kind of deal students are getting for their money. Ohio State's not among them, no particular reason, but what about that? I mean, sharing what the value is.
I chair the National Commission on the Future of the American University. This is the major commission taking a look at this very issue, access and affordability. And it's very clear that this institution that I'm the president of is one of the great educational bargains, world-class institution. We are the fifth highest tuition in the state of Ohio. Think about that. I always joke about the fact that when I was at Brown, I set tuition very easily. I waited for Harvard to set its tuition. I did $100 less. The difference in tuition between Brown and Ohio State is is close to $50,000. And a student leaves this, first of all, about 55% of our students are in financial aid. A student who, if they leave with debt, they leave with less than about $20,000 in debt, as composed with a lot of other places. That's at the undergraduate level. One of the things we need to focus on is the debt structure for our graduate and professional students, particularly our professional students, law and medicine, et cetera. And we're really focusing on that in terms of our fundraising efforts. So the answer is that for us, it's very easy to justify. Now, saying that, I think at the national level, that the student debt structure is at about $1 trillion. That's like the next housing crisis. We've got a bubble out there. So too many people are charging too high a tuition for the quality of what students are getting. And I think that we need to focus on that very carefully, and that's precisely what we're doing. So I have a bifurcated world. As the president of Ohio State, I think that we're doing a tremendous job. As the president or the chairman of this national commission, I think we've got very serious problems, and we need to close that gap, and we need to work on it very carefully over the next several years, or else we will have a crisis that we will not be able to overcome.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, as you just heard, is Gordon Gee. He's president of Ohio State University. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can go to the Facebook page. You can tweet me, at Ann Fisher, WOSU.
You're a tweeter, Ann.
I follow you.
That is great.
Well, of course. Tom and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to tell Dr. Gee what a wonderful thing it is to have one of the regional campuses of Ohio State here in Marion. To be able to have the Ohio State University this close to the population in our area, it allows so many children to go to college that might not be able to, if they had to go to a distant college, pay not just the tuition but room and board. And just to tell him what a great campus you have.
Well, you know, Tom, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I am probably the biggest member of the fan club of our smaller campus. I don't call them regional because I believe that we are one university, and I believe that that's just one of the front doors. I just visited Marion. Greg Groves and his team do a great job. We've got a wonderful faculty there. And in many ways, I will say this, I think that particularly for kids who are a little intimidated by size, that coming to the university and going to one of our smaller campuses, whether it be in Newark or Marion or Mansfield or Lima, they just get a great education, a great experience, and a wonderful collegial feel. So I love what we're doing on those smaller campuses. I really do.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Take care. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, as did Daniel. He writes, I did my undergrad at OSU, and I'm doing my master's at OSU right now, so I've been on campus for a few years now. And I'm wondering if he can comment on why the massive construction projects that never seem to end are so necessary, especially right now when my friends and I are losing financial aid and scholarships. Graduate assistantship positions are being cut, tuition is going up, and departments can't afford to keep a full staff and faculty. Why all the construction?
Well, first of all, those dollars are not fungible. If we're building a billion-dollar hospital, which will therefore generate about close to 15,000 jobs, new jobs, many of them at the university themselves, and so therefore they are growing revenue for us. But we can't take any of that money and put it into scholarships or any other thing. But besides, I think it shows the kind of progress that the university is making in investing in its infrastructure, which I think is enormously important. Secondly of all, I'll come back to what he said. The very reason that he made the case for me better than I can, which is that in terms of why we're taking a look at these other revenue sources, if we do not do that, then yes, indeed, there will be an escalation along the lines that he talked about that will be even further. By doing what we're doing, by creating a new set of revenue sources, we're going to be able to deal with some of those issues.
So revenue from the medical center, for instance, you can spend that on the university at large?
It's one university budget, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, the thing about it is, but the point is the revenue to build the facilities are not fungible commodities. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So those are bonds, and bonds you don't bond to pay someone's salary.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, thank you. Dr. Gee, it kind of boggles my mind that the same individual is responsible for the largest university and football program in the nation and the health of, you know, a third or more of Central Ohioans through the Ohio State University Hospital and healthcare system. Should those roles with such a divergence of thought report separately to the board of directors? Has there ever been an evaluation of pros and cons in that?
Yeah, I mean, I have looked at that a lot. Obviously, I've been sitting in the chair, and the answer is I think that having one university in which there is one in which there's a leadership circle which is tied with each other is much more healthy. I have seen places in which there have been separate reporting relationships to the Board of Trustees from various elements of an institution which have proven to be very unhealthy because then they become very competitive with each other. The point being is the fact that because everything comes ultimately through the office of the president, that we can make decisions which are in the best interest of the university, not in the best interest of one particular part of the institution. I think that that is a much more powerful way to think about Ohio State. And by the way, we'll enhance this over time to be able to do things we otherwise would not be able to do.
Chris, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
That was a good question. I like that question, though.
Greg in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Oh, hi. I was wondering if OSU is considering using online education to lower the cost of education. For the last 3 months, I've been taking a course called MITx. You know, it's an engineering course. It's an introductory course. But it's a world-class education. 100,000 people signed up. Probably something like 10,000 people are going to finish. And I can tell you, this is really, we're getting the best educators. The questions are randomized, so people can't cheat. It's wonderful, and the cost is free today. But with 10,000 people completing the course, they could charge something like $200 or $300 and make $2 or $3 million to pay for the support of that kind of thing. And apparently MITx and Harvard are working together in a joint effort called EDX. And I suggest you find out about that. And I wondered if you're thinking in that mode at all.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's a great question. And by the way, absolutely, we're thinking about what our particular niche is going to be. Because the world is, again, If you think about threats and analyses, one of the greatest threats to an institution like mine is precisely that, is the fact that there's this young fellow at Stanford who just gained tenure and started teaching a course, and all of a sudden realized he had 168,000 people on the course, left his tenure position, started something called Udacity. And these are the big MOOCs you're talking about that Harvard and MIT have started. The answer is yes, and we want to preserve our ability to be able to preserve our quality, but we're going to be very engaged in new and interesting approaches to this area. We're not going to follow other people. We're going to try to follow our own course, because we also believe that the power of Ohio State is the power of its educational experience that we also have on campus.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay.
Oops. Didn't mean to cut you off. My guest is Ohio State University President Gordon Gee. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome them. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Facebook and Twitter work as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Pink slime has been in the news recently, but have you heard of meat glue?
Meat glue is an enzyme that the meat industry has been using for a while. It's used to sort of fuse two pieces of meat together and make them appear as if it's one piece of meat.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Philpott, the food and ag blogger for Mother Jones magazine, talks about the meat industry. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. If you're looking for an easy way to support our station, how about joining the Sustaining Giving Program? As a sustainer, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your member card renews annually. The ongoing support of sustaining members saves 89.7 NPR News time and money and helps us focus more of your support on news programming. Make every dollar count. Become a sustainer today. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.
75 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a slight chance of a stray shower popping up today, otherwise a mix of sun and clouds and a high near 80 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 57, sunshine and a high of 82 for Friday. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Gordon Gee. He's president of Ohio State University. You can talk with them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The university has embraced a second-year programming plan for OSU students with an eye on strengthening the faculty-to-student relationships. But this should not necessarily be confused with approval for second-year housing, and that's what our next caller wants to talk about, is the idea of sophomores on campus. Tim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is Tim. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, Tim, how are you?
Good, Dr. Gein. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir.
As I'm sure I know you've answered this question in a generic way, but you might be able to give me actual advice of what you think I should do. I have about 20 rental units on the north side of campus that I've put over $1 million of extra money into that area to renovate it. And with the addition of the sophomores being required over the next few years to live on campus, I don't really know the exact number of how that will affect, you know, how many more sophomores will be leaving the rental pool for us private property owners. But what do you think for people like me? We're a little farther away, 4 blocks north of Lane. Should we start to think of selling some
no,
of our property?
No, I continue to invest. No, I don't want to give you advice, but don't come back to me later on. But continue to invest. I tell you why. So, see, this is all the data. This is the thing that my friends in the rental community don't understand. First of all, the university is going to continue to invest in the east of High Street itself, and try to make certain that all of you who have invested there that your investment is secure, because we want to continue to upgrade the quality of that neighborhood. My goal, frankly, is to build a laboratory school, to do faculty housing projects, et cetera, so that we can attract more people. Now, the data is this, Tom. This is what's important. They lose this. As we move toward the freshman sophomore housing experience, all of those who have done something similar, and I did this at Vanderbilt. What it shows is the fact that then the juniors and the seniors become so acclimated living in the campus area that they don't go to Dublin and a variety of other places. We create much more of a community. Actually, for those who have high-quality housing like you, if anything, their investment will continue to accelerate, and particularly as the university takes a look at getting more people to move into the neighborhoods through this kind of public-private partnership. So if I were you, I'd buy 20 more and renovate them.
Well, that sounds good. I know that's, you know, back 50, 60 years ago, faculty lived just east of campus and just north of campus, and a lot of the wonderful architecturally significant properties were made for the faculty.
And I want to make that happen again. You know. Let me give you just one example, because I have a snapshot. 1998, when I came, 1990.
The first time
I came, first time I drove into campus, I thought that I was in the middle of Fallujah. I mean, it was just awful what the university had done. We were the world's worst neighbor. We sucked the neighborhood dry in terms of oxygen and ability. And so we started Campus Partners, did a variety of other things. I came back in 2007. You take a look at what's happened in Clintonville. You take a look at what's happened in Victorian Village. You take a look at even in the east side with the projects that we have along High Street, et cetera. I don't know if you can remember, but in 1990, the first time I went out on a student night, the police had to string along these great big wires because there were so many bars and kids were spilling out into the street and getting run over. I mean, the whole culture has changed, and the quality of housing issue is very much a part of that. So we love our landlords. Now, you and I would both admit there are a certain number of landlords who have built shotgun houses that they charge extraordinary rent, and other things. And one of the things that I would really like to do to help someone like you is that I really want the university, and we're going through this process right now, to have its own housing inspectors. So they can go out, inspect housing, say that these houses meet the fundamental criteria for our students, and they'll be on our approved housing list. So therefore, we really do work with those of you who are doing a good job. And there are so many of our partners out there who do a great job. There are a few who probably should not be in business, and those we would certainly hope will not survive. But those who have invested and invested well, their investment's going to grow.
That'd be great. And so do you anticipate getting some traction on getting the university to do this inspection?
I have suggested for the last 3 years, and for some reason or other, someone says, well, you can't do it. I'm just going to say do it. You know, yeah. It's about time. Because
it could tie in with the off-campus.
Well, and the whole point is now with what we're doing on campus and what we're starting to do on off-campus, then we preserve our investment and your investment, too. Because because someone has put $1 million into 20 housing units, I'm going to come and live in your place. Those are the kind of places we want to have. And you ought to be given credit for that. And that's my point.
Right.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. John in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Yes. Hello. My question is this. The three things about our society that seem to be the worst and they have to do with monopolies is the financial sector, the education sector, and the medical sector. Right now, there's not enough doctors, and therefore they have a monopoly and they charge way too much. You have the opportunity to increase the size of your admissions in your medical school. This would, if you and other universities did this, this would really help a lot. Could you increase the number of students that you have in your medical school by maybe a factor of 10?
No. And the reason is the fact that medical education is A, very expensive, B, it has to maintain a level of quality. We have a world-class medical center. And by the way, we have one of the largest medical school classes in the country right now. And so we're not about increasing our size. We're about focusing on making certain that what we do very well. Now, the other issue is this, and that is the fact that there is not there is a debate, and one could make this debate, is whether or not there are too few physicians. There are too few physicians in rural areas and in specialties that we need to have. And so, I have a daughter who's a physician. She went to Harvard. She had all this kind of stuff. She wasn't going to go practice in rural America, and I wish that she would have thought a little bit more about that. And so what we're doing, we're distorting what our physicians are doing. We need to have a much broader view of medical care in this country, and that's something that universities can contribute to.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
John in Grandview, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Good morning, Dr. Gee.
Hi, John.
You'll notice that most of the questions and your answers are, naturally, about money and finance today.
Let's
try something else. How does that sound?
Well, I'm
anything else but football. I know nothing about that. So.
Well, I'm going to bring in education to that.
Right, let's try
simple.
That.
I went to Ohio State a very long time ago and took the requisite required courses, and because my English was already, I thought, rather good by that time, and my math was fine. Most of that didn't help me very much, and that's not a criticism of those then. Things change slowly. And my question, but I better set it up first, is this. This is a very complex financial world. I invest in stocks and commodities, and I know how these things work. But when I get out there and I talk to students, which I do from time to time, most of them don't have a very good handle or understanding of the way the world works financially and or money and investing. My question then to you is, have you sat around with other university presidents or the board or other people and talked about redoing some of your required courses so that it is mandatory that when people go to get a degree from Ohio State or any other comparable institutions, that they come out with mandatory courses in money and personal finance so they're not victims of the financial world when they get out, as they seem to be so frequently now?
Yeah, financial literacy, I tell you. Now that is a heck of a good question because of the fact that I worry a lot about that myself. Interestingly enough, as requiring it mandatory, we have not moved in that direction yet, although I think that there's something to be said for us making that kind of information readily available and even doing it as part of some kind of effort on behalf of the university. We will look at that. Now, we are moving to semester, so we have a lot more flexibility in some of the things we're going to be doing. Now, saying that, though, our students, and this is the heroic nature of our students have started these programs on financial literacy through the student government, a variety of other places, in which they have come to realize, because we treat them like young adults, that as young adults that they don't have the information they should have. And so they're working very carefully to create programs on financial literacy through their own efforts be able to inform students exactly what things they ought to know and what things they ought to be doing. And I think that in many ways is the most healthy way to approach this issue.
Thank you, John. We have two emails about tenure, two different takes on the issue. From Robert, he writes, a couple of months ago I read in On Campus about the new tenure and promotion guidelines. As I understand it, less emphasis will be put on journal articles and bringing in outside money, and more put on service to the community, both local and beyond. Can Dr. Gee comment on these changes, which I know he has supported for quite some time?
Well, I mean, I am very much on record in the fact that I believe there are multiple ways to salvation, and I think that the old lockstep of the way that we've done it in terms of tenure. In fact, there's this article, and the university was featured in the Chronicle of Higher Education I read last night, about that too many of our faculty are found in place as associate professors and not getting promoted to full professors. Well, part of the reason is the fact that we have these kind of rules that are very, very rigid about these kinds of promotions. I believe that that a world-class faculty requires multiple ways to recognize them. I make the case, for example, for our Department of English. We have one of the great departments of English in the country, 104 faculty members, larger than most small colleges. In that group, if I were to give the chair a block grant and say, listen, make us great, in there, he can recognize people who are going to teach and teach well and teach beautifully. And some people are going to write the great American novel, and some people are going to do a variety of other things. Some people should never see. Some people probably never should see students. But together, they can make a great department and a great university. And so, as we move to this more horizontal institution, we've got to think of ways to make our faculty happier in what they're doing and recognized for what they're doing. I will tell you something that just infuriated me the other day. I got a note from a young faculty member. We'd asked them to help us in our collegiate model that we're developing for our sophomores, and this particular person had been at an Ivy League institution where they'd worked a lot on the housing model at this particular institution. I'm not going to tell the name because then I'll get this person in trouble. And he sent me a note and said, well, he would love to do this. This is an area that he had great interest in, but he's brand new to the university, and a senior faculty member told him he wouldn't get any credit for it, and so therefore he needed to stay away from that kind of stuff. What nonsense! And we just need to recognize that the quality of our faculty is going to be determined by the holistic approach that we have, so that people get recognized for what they are doing, not simply by the structures that we put on them.
An email from Matt about tenure as well. I recently learned of talks taking place about changing the stipulations for gaining tenure at Ohio State. More specifically, I've heard that requirements for a scientific research professor could include minimum 10 years and 25 publications. It seems to me this blanket requirement would severely hinder some scientific fields and enhance other fields. For instance, it seems far easier to publish in the Journal of Biochemistry repeatedly rather than the Journal of Bacteriology. I'm concerned that the productivity of a professor will not be considered on a relative basis. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, again, that this is a complex issue. What did I just say? I mean, I think that there are multiple ways for us to take a look at this. We should not be measuring people on the heft of their resume. It should be on the quality of their work. And one of the things we really don't take a look at as much as we should is we don't take a look at the quality of some of the things we're doing. I happen to have a Nobel laureate at the University of Colorado who published one thing. He happened to get the Nobel Prize for it, and a lot of people protested when we promoted him. Think about it. Well, he only published one thing. Well, what in heck's sake are we saying to people? It should be about the quality of what they're doing, and there should be multiple ways to measure that quality, and there should be multiple ways for people to contribute to the institution. We need to be much more holistic about our views of the future of the university in order to be successful.
The commencement's coming up this Sunday.
Yes, it is.
And
the largest commencement in the history of the university, maybe the largest commencement ever conducted in this country.
The 400th commencement.
And the 400th,
which is
right. There's kind of a symmetry to that,
yes,
isn't
there? Yes,
there
is.
Right.
And it's also the last commencement of a quarter system, of a
right.
quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So what's changed? I mean, is this... It seems like as long as I've been with OSU, it's been going on now.
The change.
Yeah.
Well, it has been going on as long as you've been 3 years, and
okay.
And
well, it wasn't a coincidence.
And but I proposed it in 1990. It's been proposed before, but I wasn't as successful as I would have liked to have been there, and it was due to my own arrogance, probably. I think I'm a little healthier now, and So that helps a lot too. But also had great faculty colleagues when I came back. Dick Gunther, who was just retired, who opposed me during the first time, was really kind of the catalyst to help make this happen. The way I describe it is this, and this is not hyperbolic. We took 3 years rather than just doing it mechanically. We wanted to rethink the nature of teaching and learning, have a strategy for what we're trying to do. On June 30th, at the end of this month, we'll be a very fine, in terms of our curricular structure, a very fine 1980s university, very typical. On July 1, we'll launch ourselves into being one of the most forward-thinking, one of the most progressive institutions in the country. So many of the issues that we're talking about educationally and intellectually will be brought to the fore in ways that they have been able to up this time. So it's going to be a dramatic opportunity for us to make Ohio State into an intellectual leader in this country.
There are a lot of universities that go by the semester system, though. How does it make Ohio State special?
Well, the way it makes it special is, first of all, we actually are in the mainstream in terms of being an institution that now has symmetry with other institutions. Just think about it. Our students get out later. Our students are getting out next week. A number of universities have already been out a month, and our kids are at a huge disadvantage. And even in terms of going on to their jobs, I just talked to a young man last night. Gee, you know, I'm taking finals, and he said, and everyone else at his work is already working, and he's already fallen behind, and the people are complaining at his place. Why in heck's sake aren't you here, you know? So just on the mechanical side of it makes sense, but on the intellectual side, if we do this right, it will position the university to be in a much more powerful space.
I want to just squeeze in one more call from Melissa in Columbus. You're on the air, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi.
My son's a three-sport scholar athlete, graduating from Thomas Worthington this past June, and was heartbroken that he couldn't get into Ohio State until May. He registered in November. Been a four-point student his entire life. There seems to be more focus on sending these kids to branch campuses instead of letting them in Ohio State. I did a little research and found that there were some of the football players who scored between 16 and 18 on the ACT, getting full ride scholarships. And I don't understand why so much focus is on football and not education and letting these kids come in. I think a lot of the fundraising, in the long run, you're going to lose money because you're ticking off the people who have kids right here in Ohio and trying to bring in these kids.
Well, let me ask, was he not admitted to the university?
He was admitted in May to a branch campus in Marion. He had applied way back in November.
I'm going to cut you off right now. I'm just going to say to you, the education at Marion is university. That's a front door to the institution. I will again say that is Ohio State. Ohio State, Marion is Ohio State.
But you talk about the university experience, too, right, and how valuable it is. He's not going to get to live on campus.
Well, the point is eventually he will if he decides to have this other kind of an experience. But the point is the fact that, yes, we have very high admission standards. And, yes, we expect students to perform well in high school in order to be able to get into the institution, wherever that is. But no student, very few Ohioans are denied access to the university, and they can come in through one of our smaller campuses, which I think is a great experience. We are not denying Ohioans' ability to be able to come here. And by the way, you know, we have admission standards for various kinds of people. Oboe players just don't perform very well on SATs, but we happen to need to have oboe players to field our orchestra, so that's what we do. And so it's not simply about football or basketball or any other thing. It is about creating an environment in which we create that we have a mosaic of students who serve the best interests of the university.
Thank you, Melissa. I think that's going to have to be it. And thank you, Gordon Gee, for joining us today.
Yeah, welcome. It's always fun to be with you, Ann.
Gordon Gee, he's president of Ohio State University. Thanks to our All Sides staff, includes Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides intern Clarin Gleckler, All Sides production assistant Katie Higgins. Have a great summer, Katie. All Sides volunteer Kaitur Pessoa. Have a great life, Kaitur. Thanks for your help. And Rachel Ramey. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.